Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. By the way, there was one more Supreme Court ruling that came down today that we didn't touch with Dahlia Lithwick a few minutes ago. Get this one. The court upheld the racketeering conviction of a reputed associate of the Gambino crime family. This is a New York guy named Edmund Boyle, convicted in connection with a string of burglaries of night deposit boxes at banks in the New York area. He was sentenced to nearly 10 years in prison. Now, Boyle had challenged his conviction, claiming that the federal racketeering law was intended for criminal enterprises with more structure than the loosely organized group that broke into cash-laden deposit boxes. Isn't that a great way to get out of your sentence? The federal racketeering law, he claimed, was for criminal enterprises with more structure than his. But by a 7-2 vote, the court today upheld the conviction of bank burglar Edmund Boyle. I bet he loves his work, though. And if you're lucky enough to be employed right now, you might not be too interested or invested in whether or not your work is meaningful or even enjoyable. But my next guest says that we've come to believe that work should be something beyond a paycheck, and that this outlook hasn't done us any favors. So here now is Alain de Botton, the author of The Pleasures and Sorrows of Work. Alain, welcome back to WNYC.
Thank you very much.
And let you be the first one to correct my pronunciation of your
name.
No,
it was perfect. I love it.
Oh, good. You write that, quote, "The belief that life, work included, is essentially miserable was for centuries one of mankind's primary bulwarks against bitterness, a way to avoid dashed hopes," unquote. Now, this goes way beyond work. So is your starting point as a philosopher to question the entire modern quest for personal fulfillment?
Well, no. What I was doing is looking at work and love. And it's interesting that attitudes to work and love start to change at about the same time in the middle of the 18th century. Prior to that, no one had ever expected to have fun at work. Work was not associated with fulfillment, self-creation, and all of that. All those things we take for granted now. Similarly, love, when you're in a relationship that led to marriage was not supposed to be about personal fulfillment. It was supposed to be about handing down the family pot or plow or estate. And then suddenly, in the mid-18th century, in the U.S., in the UK and then in the US, comes this new, very beautiful, modern view that actually your work should not just be a place to get money. It should also be a way of becoming a fuller, richer human being. And similarly, marriage shouldn't just be about raising the kids. It should be about having a primary relationship with somebody who you have, you know, a deep personal connection. We are the heirs of these two beautiful ideas, and they let down probably something like 50-80% of us on a fairly regular basis. So we cling to them. And they're beautiful, don't get me wrong, but they do let us down. And so that's something, one of the ideas that I was looking at in my book.
So if we cling to them, even though they let us down, are you arguing that we should go back to a life that, as you put it, that was, or a belief that life is essentially miserable?
Well, I don't think it's one thing. I think we need voices on our society that keep the possibility of the normality of misery totally up there. Rather like, you know, old-fashioned Christianity and Buddhism have right at their foundation the idea that human life is broken. You know, the starting point is we are not in the business of perfectionism. Now, nowadays, in secular society, we are all in the business of perfectionism. You perfect your body, you perfect your health, you perfect your achievements. And on the whole, this disappoints us. This is a kind of zero-sum game. We'll never quite reach that pinnacle. And so it's quite nice to have, as I say, voices in society that are saying, you know, if your work's not absolutely perfect, if your love life's not absolutely perfect, it's okay. This is part of the human condition rather than some particular curse that has landed on you.
So before the middle of the 17th century, when this really started to change, did people find their happiness in different ways or in different areas than people tend, at least in, let's say, middle-class Western society, to look for it today?
Yes, I mean, nowadays, you know, the first question that people tend to ask each other is, what do you do? And that is not just a question about status and money. It's also a deeper question. It's like, who are you? And the person who doesn't have a job is really invisible to modern society. Anybody who steps out of the labor force for whatever reason, a mother looking after her children, somebody looking after an elderly relative, their identity is at stake. We have a really hard time valuing anything to which you cannot put a financial value. This is the problem of our society, and that is relatively new.
So you see that, you see this as a problem of materialism rather than a, because a lot of people who love their jobs or look for work that they find fulfilling say it's really more about the content of how they spend their day.
Yeah, it's not that we are materialistic. We don't work hard just for money. It's that the acquisition of money and the acquisition of a good job title becomes the route to things that we really care about, like esteem and respect. At the end of the day, that's what people respect. You know, if you said to somebody, look, we're going to cut your salary in half, but we're going to double the respect and esteem that you get from that job, which one do you want to choose? Most people would choose the higher esteem.
So listeners, do you have to love your work in order to love your life? Give us a call and react to what Alain Botton is saying. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. You can call us right now, or you can post to our comments page or our Twitter feed or our Facebook. Maggie Clark on Twitter writes, most definitely need to love one's work to love life. In fact, a bad work situation can make you ill and shorten your lifespan. On our Twitter feed, someone writes, I worked a job I loved. Now I work a job I could leave in a New York minute. I love my life regardless. Mm. So there's a couple of contrasting. But you look like you had a reaction to Maggie on Twitter.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose there's really two views of work out there. The kind of working class view of work, if I can put it that way, that says that the whole point of work is money. You know, you work hard for money, but your real life goes on your weekends and with your friends.
It is a class thing, isn't it?
It is. And then there's the middle class view of work, and that suggests that the whole meaning of your life is your work. Of course, the money's nice, but it goes deeper than that. And that's why you can work all hours, you can work on the weekend, and your friends are ultimately your colleagues. Those are your real friends. And these are two very different ideologies of work that are kind of bubbling along there in the national psyche.
What about the health argument that Maggie made, and a number of other people are bringing this up too, and what they're writing in, that if you're not happy at work, you're actually more likely, I don't know how good the science is on this, to become ill, even to die early.
Yeah, and of course the interesting thing is the workplaces nowadays tend to be quite comfortable. So how does work make us ill? It makes us ill not by kind of crushing our bodies, etc. It makes us ill in psychological terms, by boring us, by cutting us off from the meaning. You know, one of the things that people want desperately from their work is that their work feel meaningful. Now, what is meaningful work? Meaningful work is any kind of work where you feel that through your labor, you're making life nicer for somebody, either by reducing their suffering or increasing their pleasure. And that's why people love to be, you know, love to run a cake shop or be a brain surgeon or be a gardener. You can kind of see the result by the end of your working day. The problem with, you know, most people in the United States today work in companies that are larger than 500 employees, massive machines, in which it's very hard to have a sense that you're touching anybody, that you're making a difference. We desperately want to make a difference. That's what makes work pleasurable.
That's a generous definition of meaningfulness, though, I think, because you're giving people credit for finding their work meaningful if they're helping other people. There's a lot of narcissism in our society. So a lot of people might be finding their work meaningful if it just satisfies themselves, if it gives them pleasure.
Yeah, but that pleasure, you're not really going to be able to take admiration. People want to be admired. But, you know, fortunately, you're only really going to be admired if you sincerely impact on another human being. So it may be the admiration they love, but at the end of the day, that's plugged into helping society in general.
Rob on our Facebook page writes, what we do for a living, along with the families we raise, is the biggest mark we make on this world, and it is the way we spend most of our time. So, yes, it matters, especially for ambitious, high-achieving types, of which I consider myself one, for better or worse.
Yeah, but, you know, the thing is, the most high-achieving type, when that person looks at their business card and it says, you know, you're a data systems analyst or something, none of us are our business cards. There is always more of us than there is on our business card, and we feel it on a Sunday afternoon or a Sunday evening. As the sun is setting down, you suddenly think, you know, I'm probably a lot more than my job. All of us are a lot more than our jobs, and we need to remember that when judging people.
Which brings me to one of the very interesting things in your book, job titles with respect to children's books. So you're right, it is surely significant that the adults who feature in children's books are rarely, if ever, regional sales managers or building services engineers. They are shopkeepers, builders, cooks, or farmers, people whose labor can easily be linked to the visible betterment of human life. Why did you bring that up?
Well, I think that, as I say, one of the things we really want to do is to make an impact. And the problem of the modern world is it is incredibly specialized. You know how it is? You meet people at a party and you say, what do you do? And they say, I'm a packaging technologist. And you go, hey, what is that? Most people, before you understand what they do, you've got to ask three questions. That's normal from an economic point of view. A well-functioning economy is one where there are not very many generalists. Generalists do not make for a flourishing GDP. However, all of us deep down as human beings quite enjoy being generalists. The dream is to be a farmer, a baker, etc. No one wants to be some tiny cog in a giant system. But of course, that's the way the modern economy is pushing us.
Which is why you use the example of the baker churning out bread and cakes and whatever in a local village shop rather than 500 biscuits a day in a factory.
That's right. I went to investigate this cookie factory, 15,000 employees producing enormous numbers of cookies and a real sense of meaninglessness. Now, the business of making biscuits is quite meaningful. Anybody who spent the afternoon making some cookies for their children knows that it's a lovely thing to do. But once that is on an industrial scale and you're in the back office and you're processing reinsurance forms, you're kind of losing touch with the whole point of it. And that leads to that particular very modern dislocation. And I think the most enlightened corporations are trying always to make a very big machine feel like a small machine. That's the challenge.
How about that guy from the Gambino crime family who the Supreme Court says has to stay in jail? Did you do a class analysis of anything like that? You think those guys get fulfillment from their jobs or just money?
Well, I guess they get esteem, not esteem from you and I maybe, but there's a whole criminal underworld that might be thinking, hey, these guys are on the money.
If you're a capo, there's certainly a hierarchy there.
Absolutely,
right?
Absolutely.
All right, Alain de Botton, my guest on WNYC, his new book, The Pleasures and Sorrows of Work, and Daniel in New Jersey, you're on WNYC. Hi, Daniel.
Hi, Brian. A big fan, and I want to give some credit to your guest for, I think, bringing up some very, very fundamental questions. I just wanted to make a brief comment as an Orthodox Jewish rabbinical student towards, I think, what's an underappreciated of the elements of the Jewish philosophy of work, which is something of a synthesis of what your guest has termed, the pre-mid-18th century approach and the post, which is that there's an expectation in Judaism that you will be doing work which will not always be personally meaningful or fulfilling, but because if you see your work as a way of service of the Lord, as the verse in Isaiah says that the Lord didn't create the world to sit empty. He wanted it to be cultivated and developed, and many verses in the beginning of Genesis and other statements from the rabbinate in the second and third century. So if you see your work constantly as a service of God, even if it won't be personally meaningful, you can always take some measure of fulfillment through it. So that's something of a synthesis of finding right. meaning in your work, but expecting that it won't be that kind of day-to-day joy. So I just wanted to bring that up as a third perspective on the balance between personal fulfillment and work.
Daniel, is that different, do you think, than, let's say, an atheist who is still very community-minded and wants to serve the community but may not believe in God?
Of course not. Of course not. It's just whatever a person's belief system is, I just wanted to raise, the fact that finding meaning and fulfillment in one's work doesn't necessarily have to be from a personal standpoint. Mm-hmm. It could be because you see it as part of a religious framework or, as
right.
you raised, from a moral, a secular
right.
humanist framework. So there are these kinds of non-personal fulfillments that emerge from one's work.
Selfless rather than selfish. A good perspective. Alain de Botton.
Yes, absolutely. I was struck by when I was looking at many corporations. Many corporations are now workaholic organizations where you have to stay and work an awfully long time. And I remember being in an accountant's office, and it was Saturday at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and people had been working since 9 a.m. the previous day. And I started thinking about the Jewish Sabbath. And I started thinking about the Sabbath because, well, what's the Sabbath about? Objectively, it's a story about God creating the world and needing to rest and look at the works of creation. Okay, from a secular point of view, this doesn't make much sense. But it is nevertheless a fascinating story because, interpreted in a secular point of view, it's really a story about megalomania. It's really saying, human beings did not create the earth. So sometimes we need to down tools and acknowledge that we don't control the whole game. Because behind workaholism is almost like a fantasy of total control. If only we stay at the office a few more hours, if only we do a little bit more work, we will be able to kind of assert ourselves on the raw material of the earth. And so it's a nice reminder of our limits.
And Daniel, again, thanks for your call. Did you see the article in last week's Sunday New York Times Magazine called The Case for Working with Your Hands?
Yeah.
A couple of weeks ago, actually. It was written by a man with a doctorate in political philosophy. You're a philosopher. Who left his job at a think tank to open up a motorcycle repair shop. And his thesis was that swapping a computer screen for a toolbox gave more meaning to his life.
Yeah, I think there's a tremendous nostalgia for craft work. But I think my objection to that book, which is a very charming book, is that ultimately it's unrealistic. We're not going to be able to retool the economy so that all of us have gone off to, you know, the workshop and whatever. I think the goal is not to try and become like craftsmen of the 18th century. The goal is to see whether we can approach the work we actually do in a more craft-like way. You know, I was hanging out with some guys in Silicon Valley designing code. And essentially, they are craft workers. They are bringing to the craft of designing code all the things that a medieval carpenter would be bringing to the design of a table. So my conclusion is, yes, let's have more craft, but let's not get hung up on what craft looks like. It doesn't have to go on in a workshop with a Black & Decker drill.
John in Morristown, calling from the unemployment line. Not really, but you're out of work right now, John, right?
Correct, yes.
So go ahead.
Well, it's just great to hear your caller. And what's funny about this is that my wife and I actually both ran a cafe, and we had a co-partner who bought us out, and we had all of this identity, all this purpose in what we were doing, even though it was, a tremendous amount of work. And then we sort of one day didn't have any of that, and we're stuck saying, okay, what's next? And over the last 12 months, I've had the pleasure of helping my grandfather die with quality, and I was able to interview him in hospice, and we've had some really amazing things that we can draw on and say it's been an amazing 12 months. But at the end of the day, we still feel so conflicted about not having an identity. I mean, to the point where my wife doesn't want to go to parties, doesn't want to even meet new people because she doesn't have an answer to the question, what do you do?
And I totally sympathize with that. I mean, I think parties, while we're on the subject, are a really difficult thing because the whole modus operandi of the party is you meet a stranger, you exchange what you're doing, and then that's the only way to move on. And to say at a party, I don't work, is more or less like saying, I kill small children.
And John, thank you. And ironically, who else struggles with that is stay-at-home moms.
That's right.
And Judy in Port Washington, I think, has something to add on those lines. Judy?
Absolutely. I was thinking that. You're right on the nose about when I was staying home with my kids full time, I felt completely invisible. And as for going to parties, I think the wife should just say she's a philosopher.
Brilliant.
Philosopher, yeah. That's brilliant. Good. Okay, Judy, thanks a lot. You're a philosopher now.
I think it's part of a broader problem we have as a society valuing things that you can't put a dollar sign on. How do you value something that doesn't cost something? How do you value an hour with a child? You can't sell that at Walmart, but it's clearly worth something. And we as a society have a very hard time doing that, valuing things that are outside of the money economy.
Alain de Botton, author of The Pleasures and Sorrows of Work, with me on WNYC. You seem fascinated by accountants. You write that the headquarters on the bank of the Thames is the setting for a range of behaviors at least as peculiar as anything that an ethnographer might uncover among the clans of Samoa. Now, no offense to the people from Samoa, but this sounds like you're engaging in philosophical tourism. Look, the philosopher, the wacky guy who spends time studying a tribe of accountants.
Yeah. Well, I'm often struck. You know how when you first start a job, when college leavers enter the workplace for the first time, and they're full of excitement, and they notice everything, and they contact their families and their friends and go, wow, the water cooler and the lunch, etc. A year into the job, 2 years into the job, they don't notice anything anymore. There's something about the average office, which is deeply fascinating. It's full of little nuances and whatever. And I wanted to study all of those. I particularly wanted to study all sorts of themes related to motivation. In the olden days, when you wanted to motivate your workforce, there was only one thing you needed, the whip. You just hit people a little bit harder. Nowadays, unfortunately, it just doesn't work. And offices are all about the arts of management, or the pseudo-arts of management, where people above you are constantly trying to get you to work hard without noticing that that's what they're trying to get you to do. And so that's a fascinating dynamic in any office.
Do you watch the TV series The Office, either the British version or the American one?
I mean, both, and they're utterly fascinating. And, you know, something I really regret is, why is there not more ordinary work on the TV? I mean, it's, you know, there's obviously lawyers and doctors and criminals, but if you're not interested in that, you know, as you hint, there's not very much else. We live in a world which is a workaholic world, which strangely, when it comes to culture, runs away from looking at itself in the mirror. And one of the small things I wanted to do with my book was to hold a mirror up to our working lives so that, you know, we could laugh, we could cry, we could think about it, but at least we could become more conscious of something that we do every day.
You founded something called the School of Life. What is it?
It's a school. It's a school in central London that aims to teach people some of the great questions of life. So we've got courses in love, in death, in parenthood, in politics, all the things that trouble people. If you go to an ordinary college or school, you know, you get taught history and you get taught literature, but where is the big burning questions? We wanted to put the big burning questions of life right at the center. Me as an author and as an educator, if you like, I'm always interested in the relevance of things. And this was just for me a way of continuing that interest in making books and ideas relevant.
So, for example, yours is the only school that I've ever heard of that offers bibliotherapy, where you can meet with a therapist who will offer you a reading prescription to cure your particular strain of existential angst for $112.
No, it's not for $112.
It's not for $112.
No, it's £45, so that's about $70.
Okay.
And it's quite an in-depth thing, and what you do is you basically, you know, we have no shortage of books out there. One of the things that shows like yours tries to do is to say, among the millions of books that are out there, I've picked out this author who I think is worth listening to. We need editors. We need people to say to us, read this book rather than that book. But I think a lot of the time you also need to interview somebody and say, well, what are you interested in, and try and build on that interest. So as you say, it's a cross between psychotherapy and a book recommendation service. It's not available at Barnes & Noble. So we thought we'd give it a go and invent it. It's proved enormously popular.
So what would you say to this listener named Olivier, who posted on our page the secret? Oh, well, this is a quote from Oscar Wilde, actually. I see. The secret of life is to appreciate the pleasures of being terribly deceived. Do we have to be in denial in order to think that our life has meaning? Are we just distracting ourselves from, you know, the ultimate mortality of our condition?
Well, I've come to think rather generously about distraction. You know, distraction seems to be this awful thing we shouldn't be. We should focus on the big questions of life, like our upcoming death, etc. But in a way, one of the things, and I say this at the end of my book, one of the great things about work is it keeps us distracted. When you're at work, you're just looking at your agenda, you're thinking, oh, 11 o'clock, 12 o'clock, what have I got? A meeting coming up. And you're putting at bay the fact that at any minute you may drop dead. And that's pretty scary, that dropping dead thought. So we should worship work, or welcome work, for that precisely that ability to give us these relatively small-scale achievable goals which keep some of the vast questions at bay.
But is that really what you come to after a life of philosophy? That everything, even the most meaningful community-oriented work, is just a distraction from the fact that we're someday going to die?
That's one thing, but, you know, there's other things. My other theory, optimistic theory of work, is that work, when it's going well, it means that we're able to do something which is slightly better than we manage to be the rest of our lives. In the rest of our lives, we could be a little bit dishonest and chaotic and half-hearted, but when it comes to work, we reach a level of intelligence, of kindness, of symmetry, of logic that maybe eludes us. You on the radio, for example, might be better than you at 9 o'clock in the evening. Who knows? I certainly know that I on the page am doing a better job than I in the world. So it's just trying to create something that's a little bit better than you are.
Confucius said, my producer just tug up this Confucius quote, so maybe this discussion goes back much further than the middle of the 17th century or 1700s where you located it. Confucius said, choose a job you love and you will never have to work a day in your life.
Yeah, I mean, of course, the thing I always think about then is, how on earth do you choose it? And one of the people I went to look at in my book, I don't know if you saw, is the whole business of career counseling. Now, career counseling is supposed to do that Confucian thing. It's supposed to guide you to the job you're absolutely going to love. But they have real problems, those career counselors. They're a little bit like creative writing teachers who tell everybody, hey, we're all going to become great writers. The sad truth is, No, we're not. And that's a little bit the same with a career counsellor. They promise everything. And so it's wonderful when you meet somebody who's exactly the right job and it's like a hobby. That is a beautiful thing to see. But these people are in a serious minority.
Alain de Botton, that's B-O-T-T-O-N, is the author now of The Pleasures and Sorrows of Work. And if you want to hear more, he will be speaking tonight at 7 o'clock in conversation with Paul Holdengraber at the South Court Auditorium, the Humanities and Social Sciences Library of the New York Public Library. That's 5th Avenue and 42nd Street, right there in Midtown, 7 o'clock tonight. Alain de Botton, a fascinating conversation. Thank you
very
much.
Thanks very much. Thanks.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up, should we have residential parking permits in New York City? Stay with us.